from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Demonstrators descended on San Francisco International Airport and airports across the country over the weekend in response to President Trump's order restricting border access from seven predominantly Muslim countries. The order was widely condemned by immigrant advocates, Silicon Valley CEOs, and Democratic lawmakers. Here's Senator Chuck Schumer speaking on Today This Morning.
This is a blanket ban. It hurts innocent people and doesn't stop terrorism. It's just appalling.
President Trump responded to the criticism by saying that the order is not about religion, but about keeping the country safe. In this hour, we talk about the ban and the protests. It's up ahead after the news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. On Friday, President Donald Trump signed an order temporarily banning admission of immigrants from seven predominantly Muslim countries. The order has led to the detention of more than 100 people arriving at airports across the country, sparking widespread confusion and nationwide protests. Part of the order has been stayed by federal judges. And in California, Democrats are vowing to fight the ban, including Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, who is expected to introduce legislation later today. But some California Republicans are voicing support for the president's action. Congressman Darrell Issa said this to CNN today.
Although I don't want to say that this was perfectly executed by any means, and there has been some confusion, I think we have to put it in perspective that it's temporary, that it does not target people per se based on religion.
Okay.
And quite frankly, most of the critics are saying that other countries should be added if you want to catch all terrorists. That's sort of a counter message that I keep hearing.
This hour on Forum, extreme vetting and what it means for the country and for those caught in the middle of the chaos. Let me tell you who is joining us for the program. I want to welcome first Alan Gomez, who is immigration reporter for USA Today. He joins us by phone, and we welcome you to the program, Alan Gomez. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Zara Billo here in studio with us. She is executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations in the San Francisco Bay Area. CARE is the largest American Muslim civil liberties group. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Jennifer Chang Newell, who is senior staff attorney on Immigrants' Rights Project with the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. She's also co-counsel in Darwish versus Trump, which is a challenge to the recently issued executive order restricting border access from certain countries and by certain groups. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. And Alan Gomez, let me begin with you, and perhaps you can just update us on what's going on. We've seen protests across the country and at airports, and it doesn't seem to be abating, does it?
It does not. And, you know, I think one thing that's really important to state right now is that all the orders that we've been getting from these federal judges in Brooklyn, Boston, and Virginia, they're dealing specifically with people who had already arrived in the United States or were already in transit. So everything that we're seeing this weekend is dealing with this group of people that had visas to get into the country and were either detained or went through further interrogation at airports or were trying to get here. So we haven't even started debating sort of the overall legality of President Trump's order. That's something that's going to be litigated in the weeks to come. But yeah, I think it's just, again, it's, I just think it's really important to note that we're just focusing on that right now. That's what all this legal battle has been about this weekend. And so we're just trying to get some clarity on the immediate impacts of what's happened before we can really step into the broader questions.
Well, let's get some clarity on green cards, because initially it was the assumption was that green card holders came under this ban, and I guess there's been some backtracking on that. Now they are exempt, as I understand it?
Exactly. They're exempt, but they still have to undergo additional screening. And here's a bit of the problem of how this order was implemented. It was Friday night that President Trump, Friday afternoon that President Trump signed the order. Customs and Border Protection immediately started implementing it, but we did not get any official clarity from the Department of Homeland Security on who was covered, on how it was being processed until last night, until Sunday night. You know, over the course of the weekend, Department of Homeland official, White House, they held some what we call background briefings with reporters to kind of let them know what was going on, what they were doing. But if you were a traveler in any of these affected countries, if you're a traveler who's been to any of these affected countries, and you wanted to get any sort of guidance on whether you should come, on whether you were covered, there was nothing on the Department of Homeland Security, on the State Department websites. There was nothing to give you an idea of what should happen. And so, yeah, finally last night we got some clarity on this. They officially declared that people who are green card holders can enter the country. They still have to go through a further background check, more questioning once they arrive in the country. But, yeah, we finally got some clarity, and they are allowed to enter the country.
From what you've said just now and from what we've heard from many critical voices, things in terms of implementation and setting this forward seem to have been, how shall we put this, rather haphazard?
The word I keep hearing over and over is chaos. That's, you know, usually when the federal government is going to implement a new program, when they implemented the visa waiver program, when they made it a requirement that you needed additional identification to travel back and forth to Canada, let's say, this is done weeks, months in advance. They give advance warning. They make clear to people what is going to come, so that you don't have a situation where you have hundreds of people that are tied up that don't know what's going on, and in many cases did not have access to lawyers, were not allowed to talk to people who were trying to defend them. And right, that's why everything happened so chaotically. And you know, we heard a lot from the White House on the Sunday talk shows yesterday saying that the media and that a lot of people were overblowing the reaction. But I can tell you that when you don't have access to these people, when you don't know what's going on, when their own lawyers can't go in to see them, that's what prompts the chaos. That's what prompts the confusion, and that's why we're seeing all these protests and all this anger over the course of the weekend.
Again, Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today, and Zara Billow is here in studio. She's executive director of CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations in the San Francisco Bay Area, and actually the Trump administration has said the media is falsely presenting this as a ban on Muslims. That's their language. They've talked about a war with the media, and we're not going to necessarily get into that, but let's talk about whether this is indeed a Muslim ban. Rudy Giuliani, former mayor of New York, said publicly that he advised the president on how to make it appear not to be a Muslim ban, basically. And yet the Trump administration is saying this is about terror. This is about keeping people safe. It's not about religion at all. It's about the safety of U.S. citizens. And you say what to that?
I am so grateful to Rudy Giuliani for outing Donald Trump, right? For just coming out and saying he said I wanted a Muslim ban. I gave him the language for it. Refugees are not coming to the United States and committing terrorism. The countries that have been targeted when the immigrants are coming from there, again, no terrorism. That's not what this is. He took the lowest hanging fruit by looking at countries that had already been targeted by the Obama administration and put out a blanket ban. And if it weren't convincing enough for us to say that and for Rudy Giuliani to say that, the exception for religious minority refugees from Muslim majority countries makes clear to me that this is their way of saying, if you're a Muslim, you can't come in right now.
Wasn't there a precedent, though, with President Obama and Iraqis?
That's been the question here, right, is many, many times our government has done things like targeting people based on race, religion, and national origin during times of national security crisis or alleged national security crisis. We would argue that they have been wrong, but that's also why there are so many ways that this is being challenged in the courts, through the streets, through community education, is that we are going to push back on the unacceptability of this. It runs counter to our values as Americans, and it doesn't make us any safer.
And what does it do, in your judgment at least, with respect to Muslims throughout the world? I mean, there's been a lot of concern, even, you know, by some Trump supporters and Republicans, that this will simply feed the jihad narrative.
It definitely feeds the narrative that America is at war with Islam and Muslims. We don't believe that America is at war with Islam and Muslims, but policies like this, yeah, that is writing ISIS marketing for them. It also further alienates people who want to see the best in America, who want to come to America and who live here. Even just walking into the studio at KQED this morning, I was taking calls from people who are U.S. citizens coming from Muslim-majority countries, not one of the seven that are targeted, and still wondering, can I travel? Do I need to cancel my travel plans? Will I be separated from my family? What does this mean?
What does it mean to you? I mean, personally, do you have a sense that you could narrate to us or tell us?
we've been working nonstop all week last week and then overnight this weekend since the executive order came down to see the level of fear among my fellow Muslims is heartbreaking. I pride myself as a civil rights lawyer in working to uphold the Constitution and protect the rights of all Americans. And now to see the person holding the highest office in this country coming after people in this way without any empirical basis, and again, counter to everything that we believe in as Americans about treating people equally, there are no words. But I do find hope in the thousands of people that are mobilizing to push back against this, whether it's the support we're getting at CARE, the litigation by ACLU, and of course, the many, many people who were sleeping overnight at airports across the country to protect each other.
Zahra Ballou, again, is executive director of the Council of American Islamic Relations, CARE, largest American Muslim civil liberties group, and it's the group here in the Bay Area that she heads up. I want to talk about the litigation with Jennifer Chang Newell, who is senior staff attorney, Immigrants' Rights Project for the ACLU. And at this point, by the way, the ACLU is probably getting more support than it's had in many, many years. I'm talking about not only money, but membership and all the rest of that in light of this. And you have judges, of course, in three different places ordering halts to this. Update us, just if you will, on what's being done in terms of the process, the adjudication process. At this point, for example, Chuck Schumer is talking about bringing this to the floor, but what are you doing legally?
Sure. Well, the main case, Darwish versus Trump, we filed in the early morning hours. I think it was Friday night. Huge team of lawyers working through the night, not just the ACLU, but the National Immigration Law Center, the Yale Clinic, the International Refugee Assistance Project, and Kilpatrick, Townsend and Stockton law firm working. We filed that case alleging that the ban is discriminatory. It violates the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. It violates the plain language of the immigration laws, which prohibit the issuance of visas based on a person's nationality, place of birth, race, or place of residence. And in that case, we also moved very quickly to request and secure a nationwide injunction that prohibits the government from removing any of the non-citizens from the seven Muslim-majority countries who were affected by the president's ban. That case is now set. There's a briefing schedule. It's a temporary ban, and we will continue to move that case forward.
What about the Immigration Naturalization Act of, I guess, 1965? Doesn't it forbid this sort of thing, setting aside religion or national origins, in terms of banning an entire group of people or a region of people?
Absolutely. Congress recognized when it enacted that this provision that we're talking about that discrimination on the basis of national origin or race or place of birth had no place in the issuance of visas in our immigration laws. This type of discrimination is un-American. It's unconstitutional. It's against our fundamental values, and it's really shameful that the Trump administration has decided to act. Without even really vetting it with their own lawyers.
What about due process, equal protection under the law or the Constitution? Does that come into this picture too?
Yes, those are our claims, equal protection, that it violates, the Constitution's prohibition against discrimination. And also we're arguing that the detaining and removing of non-citizens without giving them access to process, without giving them access to our asylum process, violates the procedural due process and substantive due process. Among other things, as you know, the ban affects refugees and other non-citizens who are fleeing persecution in their home countries, who've already been vetted by our FBI and our national security vetting process, who've been deemed not to be a risk risk to the United States and who have been found by our immigration agency to qualify for humanitarian protections. And as a result of that, you know, those non-citizens, those refugees, they cannot be removed from this country without access to process, without violating our laws.
And again, Jennifer Chang Newell is Senior Staff Attorney, Immigrants Rights Project with the ACLU. I want to go back to Alan Gomez, who again is immigration reporter with USA Today. And Alan Gomez, I just want to get your take on where we are moving toward here in terms of vetting. There's been sort of a different semantic locale for us of extreme vetting. It takes about 24 months now, and presumably these new measures, the language is very confusing. They're supposedly only going to allow those in who support our country and love our people. I don't know how you do a litmus test on that or a polygraph or whatever. What are your thoughts?
And that's one of the many areas that are just very difficult to follow at a time when we're just getting executive order after executive order and have to run off to the next emergency that happens. But in essence, right now, the vetting process for any refugee that enters the United States is already a very extensive one. As you mentioned, it takes between 18 and 24 months on average for people to get here. They are first screened by the United Nations Commission on Refugees. After that, they make determinations who they will propose to enter the United States. At that point, the U.S. steps in, and pretty much the totality of the federal government goes through a very careful review of each of those people. We're talking the State Department, FBI, NSA, CIA, Department of Defense. They all get involved to some degree and vet these people as best they can. There's definitely quite a few limitations on vetting people that come from, let's say, Syria. They might not have all the paperwork that a normal refugee might have. They might, you know, because they had to leave a war-torn country. And so there is some question about how much information they can get about people in that situation. But once they put all that together, that's when they make the determination, once they get as much information that they can. The question now is what President Trump will do to sort of increase that if he's going to create a test that's impossible for many people to pass. If he's going to set guidelines that they have to meet that are just impossible for some of these people to meet. And this is what we're all going to be waiting for, to see exactly how they propose to increase what is already considered one of the most intense interview processes in the world.
I'm going to give out the phone number now. I want to invite you, our listeners, to join us and do want to hear from you, any questions or comments you have. And please call us, particularly if you have a personal story here or if you can let us know how this is affecting you or how this is affecting your loved ones or people of your friendship that are friends or acquaintances of yours. I want to invite you to join us right now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786, and we welcome your involvement in the program. So please feel free to join us, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Again, the number 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I'm going to go actually to Tehran and welcome Siavash Sadlu, who is a graduate student at St. Mary's College. He is Iranian. He's unable to return now to the United States because of the ban, and we want to welcome you to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We have a pretty good connection. I want to hear your story. At this point, you can't get back? Is that it?
Yeah, so I'm actually an MFA creative writing student and a teaching fellow at St. Mary's College. And this semester I was going to finish my MFA. Actually, I was just 4 months away from graduating, and I had come to Iran, you know, to visit friends and family members, and I was supposed to be back by February 10. So all of a sudden I just learned that I learned about this visa ban that will render me unable to come back to the United States, to go back to the States for a while. So, yeah.
So you're held up because the White House has supposedly backtracked on the visa ban.
Yeah, I'm sorry?
The White House has supposedly, that is President Trump's administration, has supposedly backtracked. Visas are now exempt as they weren't before. So are you unable to leave presently?
Yeah, I'm unable to go back to the States. And apparently, I mean, I'm just the whole thing is pretty baffling because every few hours we hear a new update, and I think the whole thing is pretty chaotic. So, and apparently recently even airlines have been ordered to already, you know, refrain from boarding Iranian passengers. So, yeah.
Do you have concern that Americans who are Iranian or of Iranian descent like you, who are just visiting friends and family, will be kept in Iran?
Sorry, I can't hear you clearly, so I need you to repeat
the question. Yeah, we're pretty much, I think, privy to the kind of confusion that's going on here. I want to thank you for joining us, Siavash Sadlu. Let me bring Zara Bilou into this again, and I just want to ask about this kind of concern, if there's going to be reciprocity in terms of the things that the Trump administration is doing, then Iranians who are there, who are American, have visas and so forth, are going to be maybe kept?
Yeah, so just to clarify, the thing that changed between Friday and Saturday, in addition to all of the orders that came down protecting people already here and in transit, was green card holders. So green card holders are being permitted to come into the United States, but we're warning them that they should expect questioning and delays. Visa holders are not coming in. They're actually not even being permitted to board their flights.
I'm sorry, I thought he was a green card holder.
Yeah, that's okay, but that also leads to this
thing. I'm glad we clarified that.
Yeah, that also leads to this thing about why they can't board. As I understand it, if they get here and they can't come into the United States, it's the airline is penalized, which I think is in addition to or including having to pay for the person's return flight. And so airlines are going to start to protect themselves by not even letting people board the flights over there. Will reciprocity be a concern? I believe it's been threatened in Iran, and I could imagine that other countries will say, if you're going to treat our citizens in this way or our people in this way, then why would we do any less or different with you?
One of the things that's confusing to many people is that none of these countries, I mean, they certainly have been fomenting in many ways terrorism, but they haven't had the effect on the United States that, say, Saudi Arabia has had. Saudi Arabia seems to be exempt from this, at least for the present. So does Pakistan, Afghanistan, Egypt. I mean, these are countries that have actually been tied to terrorist acts here in the United States. And some are saying these are also countries that have business interests of Donald Trump, the president of the United States.
It's complicated, right? Because we don't want to say that anyone should be targeted based on national origin. And so a ban that was only focused on Saudi residents or immigrants, visitors, et cetera, that would not be okay with us either. We don't want entire populations and countries held accountable for the actions of a few. However, it does show us that this is him starting. And we're reminding our activists and our supporters, this is week one from a president who promised a Muslim ban, then a Muslim registry, then extreme vetting. There's nothing.
Some are saying he's keeping his campaign promises.
He is, and it could get worse.
Right. We are coming up on a break. If you're on the line, hold on. We'll try to get to as many of you as we can. And that goes for, of course, the comments that are coming in. There are a number of ways you can express yourself here. And we do want to hear personal stories. If you have a personal story of what kind of effect this has had on you or your family or your friends. And again, you can also email us forum@kqed.org or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. We'll continue with our guests, Zara Bilou from CARE and Jennifer Chang Newell from the ACLU. Ellen Gomez, immigration reporter with USA Today, is also with us. And we'll talk actually to another Iranian who's here in the United States who wants to go anonymous, but who's having some serious concerns about this and the way it's affecting her. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. President Donald Trump's sweeping executive order on immigration sparked protests at San Francisco International Airport and around the country this weekend. And we're getting the latest on the legal battle over the order, which suspended immigration from 7 predominantly Muslim countries. We're also hearing from local people affected by the bans. And let's hear from some of you, our listeners. Let's go to a caller in San Francisco first. Errol, good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm from Afghanistan. I came to the United States a few years ago. And recently, a family of four, an Afghan family, were coming from Afghanistan to the area, but they were held at SFO for hours and hours. And honestly, I don't know. I haven't heard of them since yesterday. I don't know what happened to them. And this family, they were in Afghanistan, and he was a translator. He was working with Americans. He was, he worked with Americans for years in Afghanistan, and he was fighting against the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or other radical groups with American, for American values, I could say. You know, he's a friend of Americans. He is, he loves America. He worked with American in Afghanistan, and he was held at SFO. I think, you know, Donald Trump is just punishing ordinary people. This is painful, and I think this is.
Well, forgive me, not only ordinary people, but as you suggest, people who are involved in the United States' attempt to, you know, fight ISIS,
yeah,
and all the rest of it.
Absolutely, and I feel like for the last few days, I psychologically feel homeless in the United States. In Afghanistan, Taliban were trying to kill us because we worked with Americans. And our family, our children were under target of Taliban and other people. And in the United States, you know, Donald Trump are punishing us. This is painful. And I think this is a very sensitive time for Americans. Americans should, it's up to Americans. It's up to Americans to make their own decision. So are we going to live in America? Are we going to keep American values? Or America is going to be like other countries? Well, sometimes Donald Trump make a decision, or many people in this country do think that, I think this is not America. This is like Middle East, or Donald Trump is not the president of the United States.
You raised two very crucial points about American values, which is certainly at the center of this debate right now, but also about the help that Americans are receiving from people like you and others from these countries as translators, as advisors, as essentially sources of intelligence. And let me thank you for that call. Appreciate very much hearing from you. And we're going to hear from some more of you in just a moment. I want to go back, if I may, though, Alan Gomez, to you. This what the caller just raised has become kind of a central focal point of this debate, as I said, hasn't it?
Exactly. I mean, there's definitely two ways of looking at this. I mean, if you hear from the White House right now, what they're arguing is that, look, we feel that we need to improve the vetting process for people who are coming here. This is a matter of national security at a time where terrorism is spreading around the world. And so from their perspective, they're sitting there saying, look, why would you begrudge anybody who's trying to improve the national security apparatus of the country and ensure that anybody coming here has been thoroughly and properly vetted? On the other hand, I think what's caused so much of an uproar is, again, the way this has been implemented and that message it delivers. It blew me away that the first couple of people of cases that we really learned about this weekend who were detained at U.S. airports were Iraqi translators who had worked for the U.S. military over there and were detained, and it took them a very long time to get out. I've been to Iraq and Afghanistan. I've worked with translators there in the military, and I understand very well the sacrifices that they make and the dangers that they face for working with the U.S.
They put themselves at mortal risk all the time, really, just by the work that they do. Yeah.
Yeah, just the second they walk in the door and they start working with the Americans, that automatically puts a target on your back and that of your family. And so these people are just, I'm blown away every time I meet them and hear their stories about what they go through, the stress that they go through every single day of their lives. And then and I think that's why it makes it so difficult for people to comprehend that the way that this was implemented, that it took them, that even people in that situation who had made that sacrifice faced the kind of scrutiny and faced the kind of uncertainty when they tried to enter the U.S.
Alan, I know that we have to say goodbye to you, so let me just ask you a question that comes from one of our listeners named Abby and get a quick response. She wants to know, well, I'll read what she writes here. I've seen reports that the Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection officials are not complying with Saturday's federal court order and indeed have been instructed not to. Do we know if this is true?
And I can tell you that's why I have to cut off in a couple of minutes, because that's what we're trying to figure out right now. The Department of Homeland Security, I guess last night, is saying that they are no longer detaining anybody at U.S. airports under Trump's order. But civil rights and immigration advocacy attorneys say otherwise. It's very difficult right now to figure out. It sounds like there still may be some people held at LAX in San Francisco and a few other airports around the country, but DHS has made it very difficult for us to get any kind of information on this, which is part of why it's difficult to understand what's going on. So from what we understand right now is that there may still be some people detained, and then the Department of Homeland Security, what they're doing is working with airlines, working with other governments in other countries to stop any more people who would be held up here in the U.S. So they say this won't be an issue going forward, that they've resolved this with foreign airlines, and so that people will be stopped at before they even make it to the United States. But as of right now, it sounds like there could still be a few people in detention. We're just trying to sort that out right now.
Alan Gomez, I hope you continue to indeed sort it out. And thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Alan Gomez, again, immigration reporter for USA Today. I'm going to go to more of your calls. But first, let me go back to Jennifer Chang Newell, who is senior staff attorney with the Immigrants' Rights Project for the ACLU. I've got a listener who simply wants to know how this compares to, in terms of legal precedents, to previous administrations with respect to refugees. Carter administration, we talked a little bit certainly about the Obama administration. There is precedence here.
Well, certainly, for example, under the Obama administration, there have been and continue to be policies that were really making it difficult for Central American refugees in particular to come to this country and have their claims of asylum heard fairly. But honestly, this order from President Trump is really, to me, feels unprecedented. You know, the country that I believe in doesn't slam the door on people who are coming to us fearing for their lives.
Not only unprecedented, but it could be a dangerous precedent. And let me bring another caller in here, and then we're going to hear from another person who has been going through some strain under this ban. Let me get Merrick on here. Good morning, Merrick.
Morning. I just have a story. My best friend named Mohammed, a student at USF and in San Francisco, and he came back after visiting his family in Saudi Arabia. He flew into San Francisco last week, and I was going to pick him up at the airport. And I get a call from the customs that he's being detained, and they don't give me any information or let me help him. And then I get a call the next day saying he's being deported, and we're not giving you any information. So then
Saudi Arabia isn't even one of those seven nations. It's not on the list.
No, it's not. And that goes to show that the power of Donald Trump's rhetoric and the power that these immigration officers have that got to their head. Mohammed said he was treated like a pig. He wasn't even treated like a human being. And he was on the flight back to Saudi Arabia when they deported him. And, like, they didn't even give him any information on why he did, on why he's getting sent back. They said it was something to do with him. He got, like, tested a game. He made, like, $200 during his time at USF. And that means that voids his visa. But this guy said he treated him like a pig over at SFO. And it's just because he's like, man, my name's Mohammed, and that's why I'm getting treated like this. This is a guy who has spent Christmases with me, Easters, Thanksgiving. Now he's banned from the U.S. for 5 years for something so minor as testing a game, making $200 during his time trying to work as a student.
Well, Merrick, I thank you for bringing that story to our attention and appreciate hearing from you. I hope things go well for your friend. I want to go to an anonymous Bay Area academic who is actually a scientist and who has been in the United States now for 17 years and is still waiting for her green card. And she's concerned about how this ban is going to affect her personally and professionally. And welcome to the program. I know you want anonymity, so I'll just welcome you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you're waiting for a green card to arrive, and at this point you're in limbo. How do you feel affected by this ban then?
Well, first of all, I think professionally and personally, our lives have been turned upside down since Thursday. And I think on a personal level, we always considered ourselves as scientists, engineers, CEOs, entrepreneurs. And then by Friday, we were labeled as these terrorists that the American people should be protected from. So it's really hard for us emotionally to deal with it. But on a personal level, I think we have been waiting for a green card for a very long time, since end of 2015, that, you know, The process, I understand that these days takes longer, but now I don't know if it would be processed considering the ambiguity that is in the language, and our lawyers cannot figure it out, and so we probably have to wait. I have been able to travel with the travel documents a couple times.
There's going to be a lot of legal sorting out of this, and the legal battles will go on, as I'm sure Jennifer
Chang-Nu
will hear. When I say that you must feel you're in limbo, I also mean that because we just heard a caller say, you know, his friend from Saudi Arabia felt like he was treated like a pig or something along those lines, and you have the feeling that maybe there's kind of a terrorist label on you now because of this ban?
Yes, I feel that. I mean, there is even before this, there was a little bit of a difference when you arrive at the airport and the way you're treated. It's a slightly different. It's not that much more disrespectful, but you feel like you're kind of being watched differently. But I think that it actually opens up a lot of permission to hate. We are actually well-integrated members of the society. We contribute with our work in science, but also by contributing to different organizations and, you know, ACLU and EFF and so forth. And I have always considered this my home. I one of the reasons that I'm staying anonymous is because I'm an atheist. Openly here I can be, but my family is still back in Iran and I can't really out them. And for me, something that is really important is that I came here for science. I wanted to get a PhD here and do my postdoctoral training here, but I stayed because I fell in love with the American people. But also something that is very important that is going to be across the globe a matter of importance is when you are in countries that are run by totalitarian regimes, for example, Iran, there are a lot of grassroots movements, there are a lot of resistance, those who are fighting for equality. They have an idea of a land that holds equality so dear to its constitution. And this image, this idea that America is really under threat. I think for a lot of people who fight for the freedom across the globe, this image should not shatter. It should not even have a crack. It will affect all of the world.
Well, I think you're right. It's already affecting all the world. If we're judged by the responses, I mean, it's been a global response and it's had impact everywhere. I wish you good fortune and I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate hearing your story and we're going to hear from some more of you. In fact, here's Tony who writes, my family used to be Vietnamese refugees. We're eternally grateful to the United States for welcoming us when we needed it most and have become loyal and productive citizens. I'm sure the Syrian refugees today would be as thankful. Let me read somebody who supports the ban. John writes, 49 killed by a Muslim terrorist at a gay nightclub, 14 killed by Muslim terrorists San Bernardino, several killed and hundreds maimed by Muslim terrorists at the Boston Marathon, 13 killed by a Muslim terrorist at Fort Hood, 11 injured in a mass stabbing attack by a refugee Muslim terrorist at Ohio State. The list goes on and on. I'm glad President Trump acted to stop terrorism. What would you say to that gentleman, Sarah Ballou?
I was waiting for that question. Thank you so much, Michael. Of all of the examples noted, there's one person who might have been barred by the executive order that we saw come down. All of those other examples, those are people who were born and raised here. Those are people from countries who are not on the seven-country list. And again, we don't think that we need to sacrifice American values to make us safer. Counter to every instance he listed, we could talk about white supremacist terrorists, we could talk about gun violence, we could talk about police violence. But in all of those instances, again, the actions of an individual should not deprive due process rights for everyone that might be associated with, connected to, or look like that person. That's not how we operate as Americans, and that's not something that CARE or the ACLU made up overnight. That comes from our values as Americans. It's enshrined in the Bill of Rights.
And Jennifer Chang-Nu, maybe you can answer a question from a listener named Mashud who says, I was born in Iran to Pakistani parents, raised in Pakistan since age 2 with Pakistani nationality. Now I'm a U.S. citizen. What's in store for me if I travel abroad within the next few months?
Well, Zahra and I were just talking about U.S. citizens who are afraid of the impact on them. And it shouldn't affect them. The ban doesn't affect, you know, it's not explicitly about U.S. citizens, not about U.S. citizens at all. We've seen a lot of chaos on the ground, obviously, with Customs and Border Protection and how they've been implementing. We've heard just this morning on this program about an Afghan family that was targeted, the Saudi Arabian young man. Those aren't even countries on this list. So it certainly is possible that U.S. families traveling abroad, coming back, may have, you know, additional screening or be detained briefly in secondary inspection. But that shouldn't be the case. And that's not what even the executive order mandates.
Let me just say, in the next hour, we're going to talk about the politics and the role of Steve Bannon more, who's now on the National Security Council. He once said in an interview that he would like to bring chaos and have the state really sort of destroy the state and start all anew, have things crash down. These are the kinds of things that maybe make you think he meant what he said. There is a great deal of chaos here, and yet we're getting a lot of responses from those who are defending the Trump administration position. A listener tweets, to all these liberals outraged at Trump banning refugees, where were you when Obama was dropping bombs on their homelands? Let me go to another caller here, and we welcome an anonymous caller from Oakland. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I'm calling because I experienced that same treatment when I was coming back from abroad by the officers in Immigration Customs at the U.S. at the San Francisco airport. And that one was even before the Trump administration threw up this policy, this new policy. And it's always been like that with the officers up there. Even when you're holding a green card in your hands, they've been very, very bad in terms of discriminatory process, because I was observing when I was sitting there waiting for it to be called.
Forgive me, you're saying that generally there's mistreatment by immigration officers that may even have nothing to do with Muslim countries, aren't you?
Correct. Well, it was more like I was coming back from Europe, and I can see that the people who were like Caucasian-looking, white skin normally, they were treated different. All those countries who were from Canada or London or Paris or any other one person who was Caucasian, they were like very pleasant, very. And when they come to you, they really start to question you. And I look the officer and say, "Excuse me, I explained to him what happened, and he's still kind of like thinking about it. It was really, it's always been very unpleasant.
I'm sorry you have gone through those experiences, and I'm glad that you certainly had the temerity to share them with us, and I thank you for that. We want to get as many of you on here as we can. I'm also inclined to read a personal perspective here from a listener who says, I was born in Iran, raised in Canada, and now I live in San Francisco on a work visa. I can't visit my family back in Canada because of this law. And on we go to another caller from San Mateo. Hussein, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. So I'm also an Iranian. I wanted to first thank you and all the listeners for waking up to this truth that a lot of nationalities are being discriminated against, the immigration sector. And then also I wanted to point out that this discrimination is nothing new. Like, it has been going on for a decade or so, I think. When I got a job in Bay Area from outside the U.S., from the point that I got, like, the offer till I could start was a year and a month, because I had to go through all the hoops and, like, being screened by all the, like, FBI and all the other, like, Homeland Security and everything else that it can do. And then after I got my visa, I had to wait another 8 months to go through the export control process to make sure I don't expose the, like, export the technology that I will get in the tech company to terrorist organizations. So against Iranians, like, also, like, I guess Cubans, Syrians, and, like, North Koreans, like, there was this category that's been going on, and this has had, like, a big effect on my career. And so that aside, there's the fact that I have a lot of friends who are affected. My wife has been waited, like, 3-4 years to get certified medically, like, to practice medicine. And Now, we don't really know what happens next because she's in the final stages. She's very hopeful, but what if tomorrow we get, like, deported or, like, our work permits get revoked because I've heard news that, like, H-1B and everything else is going to change.
Well, again, forgive me. I mean, your story, again, is compelling in the sense of many of these stories we're hearing of being in limbo.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how you feel, and I'm glad that you brought it to our attention, and I thank you for that. And I want to read a listener comment who says, your guest keeps stating, this is not the America that I know. Please learn U.S. history. 1882, Chinese Immigration Act. 1924, immigration law for quotas. U.S. policy on Haitian immigrants. President Trump is repeating history. This is in keeping with American values. We have and do discriminate on the basis of race and religion. We must acknowledge this and change it. And we're going to hear from more of you as we move along here, but I want to remind you that you're listening to Forum, and we're talking with presently Zara Ballou, Executive Director of CARE, and Jennifer Chang Newell, Senior Staff Attorney with the Immigrants' Rights Project, with the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED Radio, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we are going to go to more of your calls. Let me get a call around from the East Bay. John, that's you. You're on.
Yeah. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up that, you know, I travel abroad a lot. And, you know, and sometimes I interact with the immigration abroad. I've also lived abroad. And in a nutshell, you know, it's not fun. You know, when you're from another country and you're doing business somewhere else and you're, you know, there to extract value out of that country in some form or fashion, you know, the job of these other, you know, countries and their border security, you know, is to make sure it's, you know, that you're legitimate and, you know, they're not the welcome wagon. So I'm a little surprised of some of the comments of people have seemed very sensitive, particularly given, you know, the situation that's going on around, you know, explosions and violence and terrorism. So I just wanted to make that comment that, you know, we have to put it in perspective.
I thank you for that comment, and we'll let it stand. Appreciate hearing from you. Let me go to more of your calls. We'll go next to Nancy. Nancy, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling from Menlo Park. I'm a U.S. permanent resident. I came here with student visa. I came here about 9 years ago. I just wanted to point something out that when I was getting my student visa 9 years ago, without U.S. government having any information, I was like 20-something year old there. It took me 3 months to get my visa. So it's not like they issue visa easily to anyone. I'm from Iran. So now my mom lives there. I'm scared to go visit her because I'm not sure what's going to happen and if I can come back easily. My sister's family live here. So if I go back, you know, I feel like somehow I have to choose between my sister and my mom. And it's been really a hard few days for me, like being a scientist to being a terrorist here. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry for what you're experiencing. And thank you for letting it out here and letting us know. I appreciate the call very much. Let me go to you on this, if I may, Zara Ballou. I mean, there are many people feeling this way, marked suddenly, you know, terrorists and so forth. But also, again, the reciprocity of this. I mean, the Iranian government, this is almost an invitation to hardliners to hold people, isn't it?
You know, I think this goes back to something that one of the other callers said about the welcome wagon, right? We're not saying that America has gotten it right before or that Obama got it right. We're talking about our professed values, the stuff that we want to live for, why we think that people should come here, because we do welcome them, because we treat them equally and with due process. And so other countries aren't the standard. Can we accept reciprocity? Can we expect reciprocity? Yeah, very possibly. And is the level of fear in the community something that I haven't seen in recent years? Absolutely. We've seen so many people crying, people nervous, people just worried about, can I ever see my family again? Do I leave? And how, you know, can you give me a timeline on when this will all be lifted?
There are people who are also angry. I mean, exacerbating some of that anger.
For sure. There's a level of incensed, right? Like, this is what's coming. We can't believe it has gotten this far.
Let me bring Emily on here. Emily, thank you for joining us. Thank you for waiting.
Michael, every time we have these kinds of conversations for the next 4 years, We have to talk to the people who elected Trump. We have to include the message that this isn't going to make you safer, this isn't going to get your job back, and we have to look for the commonalities we all have so that we can defeat him any chance we get.
Okay. I thank you for that call. We'll let that stand as well, and we'll try to bring another caller on here while we have time. Greg, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning. I had a few points, but at a time, so the main thing I'll call out is, you know, in last year under Obama, we still saw multiple attacks, and it's already been pointed out that most of them were not from refugees. So my question is, what is going to happen when the next attack comes from who Trump will say radical Islamic terrorism, but it won't be from a refugee? I feel like he'll have no choice but to escalate in some other way and take away more and more of our rights. So thank you for having this conversation, and I'll take comments.
All right. Well, thank you for that comment. We'll let that stand. Final word about the legal fight. Well, we have a few seconds left here, Jennifer Chang Newell. What do you hope for? What do you expect?
Well, we're going to continue working hard, standing with all of the Americans out there and all of the Americans, immigrants and non-immigrants, to fight these unjust, unconstitutional and un-American policies that the president is coming out with. We will continue to work with you and for you on these policies.
Well, I thank you for joining us, and I want to thank also Zara Ballou, who was also here with us in studio from CARE, and thank the you, our callers. Thank Alan Gomez, too, from USA Today. And remind you that we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And Forum is produced by Irina Gucci, Tina Larberg, Judy Campbell, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font and Jeremy Siegel. Our interns are Stephanie Roberts and Devin Holt. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Holly Kernan. Thank you for joining us. Another hour ahead, we're going to explore more of the politics behind what is going on. Stay tuned for that for all of us here at KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.